We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And today we are looking at the Omega Factor, Power of Darkness. Some college students are messing about with forces they don't understand. They are playing with a Ouija board. They contact someone or something named Effie that warns them to beware. One girl at the table is particularly disturbed. Her name is Jenny, and her boyfriend Ian is in hospital. Something mysterious happened to him. Meanwhile, Tom's brother Michael is slowly improving. His memory is still bad, but he recognizes Tom. He also tells him that Julia came to visit him. That's a bit awkward, since Julia is still dead. But Tom doesn't tell that to Michael. Michael also has an odd reaction to Anne. He doesn't recognize her, but he also doesn't want to know her. He also recognizes Martindale's name, but nothing more. Coincidentally, Jenny's boyfriend, Ian, is in the next room. Jenny is visiting and very upset. The doctor asks if Tom and Anne can give her a lift home. They agree. Leaving the hospital, both Tom and Jenny momentarily see Morag, but she's gone when Tom stops to confront her. Tom is now curious about what the now-dead Drexel is still up to, and curious about Jenny, because she saw Morag too. Later, Ian seems drawn to Michael. He tells them they must stop Omega. Back at Jenny's flat, she explains that she and her three roommates do the spiritualism stuff for a lark. She fails to mention that one of the roommates is making extra money doing experiments with Martindale. Her boyfriend Ian was experimenting with lots of different drugs, especially those that he felt might give the second sight. It was one of those experiments that went horribly wrong and produced the mental breakdown that has him in the hospital. The next day, the students try past life regression, resulting in Jenny beginning to regress into a past life. She was apparently Effie. Tom has decided that he needs some feminine companionship and puts his desires to Anne. She starts to acquiesce, but then Tom suddenly decides to go ask Jenny some more questions. That puts Anne right out of the mood. Tom is an idiot. Tom arrives to see the latter part of the hypnotic regression as Effie recounts her burning as a witch. Ian spontaneously combusts in the hospital and dies, but not before burning Michael, the poor luckless sod. After Ian's funeral, they do it again. This time, Jenny is stuck in her past life and leaves. The others are frantic and call for the help of Tom, Anne, and Martindale. Eventually, Tom's powers locate her at the cemetery, where she's calling forth her master. Tom sees him. He's some sort of a demon, but he cannot break her out of the trance. Martindale arrives with drugs to enhance Tom's psychic powers, and Tom enters Effie's mind, trying to pull her out. In a bizarre experimental theater production, Tom and the demon battle for Jenny. Tom has help from Morag, but as he escapes with Jenny, he stabs both the demon and Morag. Here's gratitude for you. After he's gone, the demon becomes Martindale. Yay! Everyone's fine again. But when Tom looks at the knife on the ground, he sees the Omega symbol. So, a bit of a departure from the last couple of episodes that have been sort of more conspiracy, government-y thingy.
True, although we do see that Morag still exists in this post-Drexel Mortem Omega Factor, so there's a kind of crumb for those of us following the overall arc.
Unless, of course, she's no longer here now that Tom stabbed her in the mind. Okay. So, is this what college students in England do?
Well, sit around in Scotland.
Number one. In Britain, in Great Britain, dude, is that what they
say? You mean seances?
Yeah. Sort of cluster together in small groups of roommates and just get up to no good kind of thing? Is that.
I never did. I mean, I imagine that's what American students do all the time.
Well, but they live in bigger groups, I think. I don't know.
Oh, right.
It's like Animal House and stuff. It's the frat houses. But yeah. No. I don't know. This is it really isn't exactly germane to the story, but it does just seem like a strange living arrangement that they've got going there. It's not that they got two guys and two girls,
right?
Or I don't know. It's just something odd about it. It just feels, maybe I don't understand how the house is structured, or maybe I'm, and it's not prudishness. I don't know. I've never, now, hard to say.
We don't see it, but my assumption is, just in case you're wondering, that they don't all sleep in the same bed.
Oh, I don't. Oh, no. It's nothing to do with that. It's just sort of, it feels like they're more of a club than a group of roommates. Does that make sense? Maybe it's the way it's staged or acted or something, but it just seems more like four people drawn together to get up to mischief than it does two couples sharing expenses by living in the same place. And, you know, we have the guy whose name eludes me at the moment, who's also working for Martindale, but nobody bothers to mention that. Although I don't know why they would, but it just, I don't know. It seemed awfully conveniently set up. It triggered something in me that made it suspicious. Like, maybe these people have been brought together for this purpose, as opposed to being a natural arrangement of students together.
It seemed perfectly natural to me, I have to say.
Hmm.
They wouldn't. Obviously, they are. You know, it's a cheap way of living. You get a bunch of students to share a small Edinburgh apartment, and as you know, students aren't going to be able to afford their own house or, you know, to live individually. So they're going to choose to get to live with people who they get on with, who they're mates with. So,
Yeah, no, that isn't what's.
I mean,
wrong.
Just because we didn't do seances, you know, in my student flat at university, doesn't mean that we didn't hang around and do other.
Watch Doctor Who.
We didn't watch Doctor Who, although we did have a TARDIS in our living room, though. That's another story.
Oh, well, that's good enough, I suppose. yeah, all right.
But hang out and pass the time, and yeah, I mean, you know, if some people want to pass the time by having a seance, then that's fine.
Hmm. Okay.
Especially in 1970s when there were fewer TV channels.
That's true. I didn't see a TV in there. Well, maybe I did. No, I didn't see a TV in there, but that's set dressing. But anyway, so what did you think of the episode as a whole?
I enjoyed it. I thought it had a particularly interesting mix of, again, I mean, we've kind of touched on this, the scientific approach to things like telepathy and telekinesis, combined with the complete way out there spiritualist nonsense like reincarnation in this case. I mean, obviously reincarnation was the theme of the episode, but it's all taken ever so seriously when, you know, they talk about drugs and clairvoyance.
Hmm. Well, so this has been you know, something that we've talked about on the side, and there is complete and absolute nonsense, the psychic aspect, as far as the universe is considered. Psychic powers are completely ridiculously nonsense. They have no basis in physics or fact or testing. I mean,
indeed,
you know, it's rubbish. But
if you're going to posit that they do exist,
you do.
And if we've already got Martindale using hypnosis, for example, to try and make people receptive to telepathy, or make mm-hmm. people more able to focus those abilities, then it doesn't seem inconsistent that using drugs in some way might focus or alter those powers, you know, given all the kind of other psychological and physiological effects that we know drugs to have.
Yes. I mean, that's fairly common from that time. When in the 1970s in particular, and I should have done a little more direct research, but there were several universities, big universities, not just crackpot ones, that were, you know, conducting experiments into a lot of it had to do with the second sight, if you will, the ability to read the backs of playing cards or know when someone was in the room when they, you know, that sort of.
Yeah, with you know, the playing card tests were the kinds of things that in episode two were being done on Crane,
right.
You know, in order to kind of establish this routine of actually doing some kind of systematic analysis of what kinds of powers he might have.
Now, and those things were going on, and they were producing a certain amount of positive results. Now, what it turned out to be almost universally was researcher bias, and consciously or subconsciously, fraud of you know, people either fooling them through trickery, and then not having the controls in place to prevent that, or sort of cherry picking. But you know, to this day, there are still people that, you know, dogs are psychic. They know when you're coming home, even before you come home, and et cetera. I mean, so there's still a lot of people that believe in it. But I guess it's very hard. It's very hard for me to put myself in the mindset of the 1970s and try to forget all that we've learned since then. But if we do posit that such powers are possible, is past life any more implausible?
Yes, it is. It's completely way out there. I mean, the fact that this research was being done by, you know, if you say kind of serious institutions as recently as the 1970s, and from the point of view of this show, you know, that it might even have been contemporary, mm-hmm. that at least gives it some possibility of plausibility that really reincarnation has none. I mean, was the research going on into reincarnation in the 70s? It would certainly surprise me.
I don't believe that is the gist of the research. But I guess what I'm getting at is that there are properties to the mind. We've had this discussion elsewhere. Is, you know, are you reductionist on the mind, or is there something greater to it? And this posits that there's something more to the mind than the sum of the parts that we can understand. That there's some
reincarnation
sort of...
does. I'm not sure that clairvoyance necessarily does.
Really? Well, that's interesting.
Well, yeah, because I mean, you can be a complete reductionist, but say some kind of, you know, it's like the theory of ether or something, you know, that worked for its time in the absence of anything better to explain physical phenomenon. And obviously what we have here is actually an absence of phenomenon, but if you are getting positive results from tests on clairvoyance and things like telepathy, and you want to try and explain them, then the idea that there might be something generated by the physical mind that could be detected by another mind, and, you know, you might do things like testing on distances or whatever to try and explore that field. That doesn't require there to be a spiritual dimension. That doesn't require there to be a soul that is completely separate from the body.
No, but it does imply means that there is something separate from the body. There's some.
No, it doesn't. We've still got this problem with qualia. We don't really understand consciousness. Something is generating it. We are much more advanced in our understanding of the connection between those experiences and the physical brain and things like whereabouts in the brain, you know. So our maps of these things are much more complete now. But nevertheless, you've still got to accept there is something there about the nature of consciousness that we don't understand. And certainly without some of that more recent knowledge about the physical way this stuff works, the idea that having a thought, recognizing your own identity, developing self-awareness or whatever, might produce some kind of physical phenomenon that we had not yet detected by conventional means doesn't seem awfully far-fetched to me compared to, say, the idea that you could go on living once your body was dead.
Okay, then let's try this. When they're playing with the Zener cards, mm-hmm. And Martindale pulls up a card and he asks Tom what the card is. And Tom comes out with better than statistically possible results from random chance. Is that because Martindale can see the card and Tom is mind to mind? Or is that because Tom has some ability to tell what's on the card? In other words, if Martindale's eyes were closed or he didn't pick up the card, would Tom's results be as good? Right?
Well,
I'm going to carry this for a few steps forward, but let's start with that one. That's the simple one. Is it mind to mind, or is it some perception that Tom has that does not rely on another mind?
Well, you could easily design a test for that. I mean, the kind of quantum level problem of measurement type issue might arise in the sense that you would have to record what was on the card somehow and what constitutes a mind. But certainly you could do a test where you say, you know, does it matter whether it's a human mind or does it matter whether it's recorded by a computer or whatever?
Mm. Okay. So now if Tom sees an event or something, he has a vision of a dead woman in a room somewhere, and he sees flashes that lead him to that room. Where is that coming from? Is that him detecting it in the natural world, or is that him getting an afterimage from another person's mind? Is it, again, is it mind to mind, or is it mind to nature?
Well,
what I'm ultimately getting at is we don't know.
We don't know. We're not given that information. There is a strong implication that it is mind to mind, that it's Drexel actually projecting that into his head.
But when we come up with things like the Omega symbol, or when he saw that guy in the hospital, which doesn't seem to be a Drexel thing,
or when he sees the guy in the church, and it's
mm-hmm. that right.
That I mean that stuff to me, because that's all kind of, he's in the church, and I'm almost thinking, you know, are we dealing with the devil here? It kind of crosses over, and this is what I mean about the idea of reincarnation, the whole spiritual stuff. It kind of crosses over into the territory of Russell T. Davies's the Second Coming. Have you seen that?
I haven't seen it now.
It's a series that predates Doctor Who, but had Christopher Eccleston as the saviour in it, and basically the conceit is that you know, he really is the reincarnation of Christ, and the devil exists, and so on. So Joe Hearn's Apparitions is another one where, you know, it's simply the idea that miracles do exist, but the, you know, the devil is real and manifestations of the devil are real, but taking that and dealing with it in a kind of rational way. How, you know, what would your approach be? How would you deal with that? What are the rules of the game? Much the same way as
Ultraviolet.
You know, Ultraviolet. We actually looked at, but you know, with stuff, with the kind of religious stuff and the God and the devil stuff, there's a whole other dimension to it that I kind of wonder if there's a deliberate crossing into here when we see that stuff in the church, because to me it looked a bit like the projection that he was seeing was a manifestation of the devil, perhaps. So it wasn't clear whether it was Jenny stroke Effie who was projecting it to him, or whether it was something that he was seeing independently.
Right, and I would have referred to him possibly as Satan or the devil in my recap if it had not just said demon in the credits.
Oh, well, just a demon. Well, that's
just
okay,
just
then.
Just demon, yeah. So, because I thought it was just a surgeon in a black surgical outfit, but or a woman. I wasn't sure in some of those shots. It's like, I'm not sure if that is a man or a woman, or supposed to be Satan or the dark surgeon or the black guardian. Or I don't know. But
certainly a lot more ambiguity to it. I mean, both
horns would have been nice.
Both of the series that I mentioned are very interesting, and I think The Second Coming is well worth a watch. But I appreciate the fact that in this there's a real question mark over what actually we are seeing. So we're not, certainly at this stage, we're not allowed to draw any conclusions from it.
I'm not quite done with the reincarnation, though. From a scientific standpoint, trying to play devil's advocate, we don't know. All we are presented with is the manifestation of the phenomena. A girl is hypnotized. A girl thinks she's now, 15th century? 15th, 16th century witch.
Mm-hmm.
And her boyfriend catches on fire, which seems like that's probably... Assuming that, let's say, she has psychic abilities and that she is susceptible to picking things up, how do we know that this isn't just some sort of... If Tom can manifest an event that's happening somewhere else, who's to say you couldn't manifest something that happened in the past? And because you're under hypnosis, you are suggestible, she could take on those attributes. In other words, quote unquote, past life regression may not be past life regression. It may be a manifestation of this echoes or these other sensory things that, for all we know, have been leaving things behind, in the same way that the stones can be resonated with sound in, what was it, the second or third episode?
And yeah, can produce in the second episode where...
Can produce Vikings.
We had picks. The ghosts.
So, you know, it could simply be that. So in other words, it hasn't been examined enough for us to say whether or not it could have come up from a scientific... They could have been a scientific explanation that does not involve a soul, per se. If a ghost in a house is not a soul, it's an echo, then why couldn't the echo enforce itself on somebody who's impressionable or in a state?
I mean, I think what is interesting about it is the approach the show takes towards it, because any number of these shows... we had this discussion about whether, you know, what sci-fi is and... whether there is a nice clean division between science fiction and fantasy, and concluded that no, there isn't really a nice clean division. And for me, the most important distinction that you can make is the approach that the shows take towards these things. So you could take something like reincarnation or manifestation of ghosts or whatever, but take a very rationalistic approach to it, in the sense of suppose this happened, how would you go about, if not explaining it, trying to kind of measure and evaluate what the phenomenon actually was. I think the X-Files is probably a very good example of that. And I think what's going on here is there are some things in the Omega Factor where clearly the characters we're following do take a very scientific approach towards the phenomenon that they are interested in, such as ESP and telekinesis and so on and so forth. But then things like ghosts and reincarnation turn up, and they don't quite know how to deal with them. It's not so much that they just abandon their rationality and accept them, but there is not quite the same. They don't seem to be equipped with the same scientific curiosity to deal with things like reincarnation, if that's fair. They're not positing the explanations that you are.
Have they even remotely investigated anything that Tom has run across? They really haven't. I mean, Martindale's doing research back in his lab, but apart from the house that they sent a team out to, have they taken anything that Tom has come up with and said, you know, we ought to investigate that? They haven't.
No, well, you can see it would be difficult to you know, conduct a controlled experiment on some of these things. They're reacting to the situation of Effie, for example. But, you know, the interesting thing about it is, I think you're proposing solutions, and they really aren't, as far as I can tell. They're kind of taking it at face value.
Oddly enough, though, I mean, Martindale does seem to have a plan, doesn't he?
Perhaps.
At the end, I mean, he shows up with the drugs needed to help Tom launch in. And you know, we're not even going to try to be coy here. We see his face materialize over the demon. So the showmaker are trying to cast doubts in our mind as to Martindale's agenda.
Indeed.
On this one, more than anything else.
Yes, I thought that was very interesting.
Also, the fact that they're sitting around the apartment at one point, and Martindale just suddenly kind of hops up and says, well, I don't think I can do any good here. I'll go back to the office, and he leaves. And I'm not even sure anything really happened after that in that scene, now that I recall. But it just is one of those things, like, it seems like Martindale had something he had to do, and it could be used as a sort of suspicious moment that says maybe, you know, there's another agenda
he's
going
up to
on
no
here.
Good.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, for a guy who is, if he is the bad guy, he's doing a reasonable job of coming off as a fairly good guy. You know, he's not twirling his mustache or anything throughout the course of the episode. But he has poo-pooed Tom a few times when, considering how phenomenal Tom's powers are, you'd think he'd be more receptive.
Yeah, well, obviously, he doesn't like Tom. So.
Well, yeah, I suppose. I suppose that's true. It doesn't seem like it'd be a huge dislike, but it doesn't. Yeah. Certainly doesn't think of him as a friend.
So the feeling I've got from Martindale is I really love John Carlyle's performance in this, and he's just been terribly consistent in his behaviour. He is very kind of work focused. He doesn't like Tom. He does like Anne. He's not completely two-dimensional. He does, you know, we first encounter him in a social situation and everything, and he does have more of a life than, you know, just an obsessive boffin. But on the other hand, he is clearly a leader in his field. He knows what he's doing, and he's pretty determined to do the work he's doing.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see where this goes. He's obviously the head of the Omega Society. That ring he wears probably has a little secret lid that flips open, and underneath it is the same ring that that Drexel was wearing last week.
I think if it's as straight a twist as that, it will be disappointing in the light of the way he's being played.
Okay. Michael. He remembers Martindale.
Uh-huh. No, he doesn't.
No, he remembered the name. I know the name, but he didn't.
Oh, okay.
He didn't seem to be able to pull anything out. But then when it comes to Anne, don't remember you. But more than that, I don't want to know you.
Yeah.
What did you take out of that?
I have no idea. I really didn't. I had no idea what was going on with Michael. And I presume it's something that's being held over, you know, just keep that strand of the story arc ticking over, because we're going to learn something more about that.
Well, I'm coming back to, he was working for Martindale against his brother, or to research his brother. Martindale's the one that got him to leave when his brother came up to town, so that, I don't know whether he'd have a place to stay or just so he wouldn't be around him for whatever reason.
Yeah.
When Julia dies, suddenly he's, I've conveniently got this scholarship to go to Europe. And I'm still thinking that didn't seem right at the time. And I'm still thinking he was out working for Martindale. And that's probably where he was when he got his brain fried.
If that is where he was when he got his brain fried, how did he end up on the hills around Edinburgh?
Well, I think that's where he got his brain fried. I think he didn't go to...
Oh, you don't think he went to Europe?
I think somebody was helping him by posting postcards or something of that nature from Europe to keep Tom off base, but he was off in Scotland doing something for Martindale. Let's say for Martindale at the moment.
I still think it's plausible that Martindale wanted to get him out of the way and therefore manufactured this opportunity to just get shot of him and didn't expect him to be back. So he was as surprised as Tom. I don't know.
Could be.
Both explanation.
Yeah, endgame, I don't know. Whether he's trying to get rid of Tom, or Michael, or whether he was trying to
use him for some other way.
I can't think
what use he is now, but yeah.
Yeah, as he is, no. I suspect, But, you know, maybe...
Well,
maybe...
I mean, I don't mean with his brain fried. I simply mean now that Tom has been brought into Department 7 and Michael's previous work for Department 7 was monitoring, you know, covert monitoring of Tom, he's effectively redundant in that regard, unless he has any other special skills that they could use. I can't see what they would want to employ him for.
Well, okay, two questions. One is that all Julia was doing too, or did she have some other job duties beyond just keeping an eye on Tom? And second off, if Tom has the powers, isn't it plausible that, assuming you're taking a scientific approach, that it could be in some way genetic and...
Possible, yeah.
Tom or Michael might have something too.
That's certainly possible, yeah.
So, but yeah, strange. Of course, he's in the same hospital with Ian, but then that could just be because Edinburgh is such a tiny little village that they only have the one hospital, and they only have the one ward, so that the two patients happen to end up in... Well, it is a psych ward, probably, so that probably end up in the same ward. Or is it that this is the hospital that Martindale sends his experimental rejects to? Because I think we can put Ian with Martindale too. I think
it would be a big coincidence if he had a completely independent interest in the clairvoyance and his flatmate was the only one who knew Martindale.
Well, I think they were all doing it, weren't they? Didn't the way the guy...
The implication was that they'd all been involved in experiments. So yeah, no, I think
yeah.
I mean not that I necessarily think it's that likely they would go to separate hospitals anyway, but I think the kind of this is where Martindale's casualties, shall we say, get patched up or not patched up, but
kept out of the way,
kept there until they get cooked
or burned alive. Ah, poor Michael.
Poor Michael, poor Ian.
Well, yeah, okay. Poor Ian, but he was an incidental character that was probably doomed for death from the beginning of the episode. But I think he catches on fire, and what does he do? He runs into Michael's room and burns him.
Yeah, well, Michael's certainly having a bit of a bad time of it, and I have to admit I just have a bit of a giggle when Martindale rings up Tom and says, it's about Michael... There's nothing to worry about, and I'm thinking, you know, Tom is now thinking of all the kind of psychological problems and whether he's had some kind of relapse. And he says Michael's a bit burnt. Oh God!
But he's fine. Oh, he's God. Fine.
Yeah.
Well, then I want to question the other guy. Oh yeah, well he's dead. that'd be a bit difficult. He's dead. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess that was just in there for the action. Why would Jenny, having Effie's recollection of the past, cause Ian to burn? That one...
Because they had some kind of psychic connection, and we saw that earlier.
Did we see that earlier?
We did see it earlier, because I made a note of it, but...
Oh, he did have some reaction to something that was going on in the séance, didn't they? They did cut to the hospital.
Either she saw him, or he saw what she was seeing. I can't remember exactly. It's near the beginning. I'd have to watch it again to actually pin it down. But there was definitely a suggestion that there was some kind of psychic connection between the two of them. So when she has this very extreme experience of the actual burning, what seems to be happening is he has the same experience at the same time. Only when he has it, he actually catches fire, unlike her.
Wow. Bad luck for him, good luck for her.
Well, yes, relatively speaking.
Michael also gives Tom a warning. Beware the dogs. Is that what he said? I didn't go back and listen to it again, but I'd swear he said, beware the dogs.
I didn't note it, but wouldn't that have been the dogs that he was going on about in whatever
it
was?
Oh, I suppose it could be. All right. I didn't take it that way, but yeah, I suppose it could be. Beware the dogs. I figured there'd be a dog attack later in the episode, and then suddenly... Tom would go, wow, my brother's clairvoyant too, or something of that nature.
The dogs are still a mystery, aren't they?
No, the dogs were mad like he was.
Oh, they were driven mad by the noise.
By the noise, yeah.
Yes.
That was it. They either died or they were driven mystery. Mad by the noise.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, it was that. All right, let's set our set our study of his family aside here for a second, and let's talk about Tom's love life. Wow.
Well, he seems to be over Julia.
Wow, does he seem to be over Julia? I mean, I've been mentioning that all along, that his interest in Anne seems remarkably inappropriately too soon. And I mean, we don't know exactly how long it's been, but I think at one point, either this episode or last, Julia's only been dead a few weeks. I think we're in relatively real time here with the show and the episodes. And not only is he over her way too soon, and of course he had that bit with reaching out to kiss Anne in the last episode, which was bizarre in and of itself, and we can talk about
it. But that wasn't conscious.
Right, but this was incredibly caddish. Maybe this is the 70s talking, but wow. That's a hell of a line he was using on her.
To me, there seemed to be something a little bit perfunctory about it. Like, almost like he was sort of expected to chat her up. Because there wasn't anything terribly seductive or romantic about the way he did it.
Right.
And it didn't work.
Well, you know.
And I don't know if he was expecting it to work, because really, he could have gone about it more elegantly.
An orangutan could have gone about it more elegantly than that. That was. I have never seen a more awkward, a teenage nerd trying to ask out a cheerleader could have done this more elegantly than his. You know, I'll try to get some sleep. I'm going to need more than this drink. Conk. How about some human contact? It's like, oh, I cringed. I cringed in my chair. I'm like, if that works, I lose all respect for Anne. And it
did. He got a cuddle out of her there. But at least he sort of, you know, got her to come over and sit down next to him. But the whole
she bristled.
Line
at least
about,
she bristled.
Well, okay. Yes, but then the line about you know, if she'd gone to bed,
yeah.
That was just like, oh
yeah,
and obviously also the fact that once he got a cuddle out of her, he was like, right, I'm off to go see Jenny now.
Yeah,
it wasn't like he was that keen to kind of stick around and take that further.
It was an extremely odd scene, and well, again. Trying to put yourself in the 70s, which, you know...
I'm not sure some things haven't changed that much.
I'm sure some things haven't changed, but some things have changed. And I'll give you a good example. When I was in junior high school and high school, which was mostly in the 70s, that period of time, it was all about the sexual revolution. You know, free love in the 60s and you know, the birth control pill, and finally sex has been freed from the staid 50s conservatism. And, you know, you had everything to look forward to when you were 14 years old, to be, once you were out of your house, of all the sex you wanted. Now, obviously, it's an unrealistic expectation of human, but in other words, there was that sort of in some
human.
Just
going
to get
down the end of the path.
Yeah, but you just see, you know, that was sort of the mentality that there was this breaking out of this repressive.
Sure.
Thing. But then,
exactly managed to put it back in the box of state conservatism.
No, but along
yet.
Came AIDS. And although
right.
It was predominantly, at that time, confined to people who were homosexuals, it put the fear back in people in many ways. Mm-hmm. Apparently, it didn't put it back enough for some people because they died from it. But, you know, there was now something that wasn't God and religion and societal norms that said actually – or the fact that you might get gonorrhea and have to go down and get an injection of antibiotics to cure it is like now you could die. And you know that started to jump over about the time that I was 18. It was very depressing. But looking back in the 70s, that his attitude is what I expected adults to be like. It's like, yeah, what the heck? Let's hop in sack. It's not real, but it's kind of the myth that was being perpetrated. And but that, nonetheless, that... it was still horribly, horribly, mechanically awful.
But that's perhaps, I mean, what you're describing in terms of the kind of cultural expectations are perhaps what I was picking up on when I thought this felt like a kind of perfunctory past that was more about what maybe Tom felt was expected of him than what he actually wanted, if that makes sense.
I did not get that from the expression on his face. That was pretty lechy. that was just slime ball.
I absolutely agree. I'm not denying that for an instant.
So is this all tied up with Michael not wanting to know? And is it tied up with some reason for Julia's face being superimposed over Anne's face? Is there something going on that's either trying to bring them together, perhaps something nefarious, or vice versa? I'm not sure exactly.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think this was a clumsy thing, and maybe, I mean, your criticism is too soon.
Well, that's one. But I mean, that is one.
Yeah. Well, he should be sad.
What I'm saying is,
I think we have seen there is an attraction. I mean, certainly for the first couple of episodes, it seemed to me, and I think you agreed with this, that it was Anne who was interested in Tom.
Yes. That is how
it seems to have kind of turned around in the last couple of episodes with Tom making these sort of half-baked passes and getting spurned. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Anne's not interested, I think. So I still think there is some kind of genuine attraction going on there. It's not just some kind of supernatural kind of love in idleness nonsense that's being used to force them together when in their own natural minds they wouldn't want to.
It's really hard to tell because Anne has turned to me. She feels like she is not with the program since episode 3.
Well, she's certainly not going to fall for any of the lines that he's tried so far. I would say that.
Fair enough. It's like they haven't been very good.
No, as you said last week, she did turn out to be quite easy when the chap on the train offered her a sip from his flask. So
yeah, I mean, maybe that fits with that 1970s thing. It's like, well, you know, it's a thing you do and people enjoy it. So why not?
Yeah, maybe I'm overestimating the amount of work needed to
and particularly
to
the British, I might add.
I beg your pardon?
Sorry.
You calling us all sluts?
Again, back in that time frame. not exactly.
We've grown out.
No, that's not
today,
exactly. I'm calling you European. And, you know, the Europeans have a little bit more worldliness about these affairs. Like that is also kind of a stereotype that comes out from that period of time, that it's probably because British television was not as conservatively constrained by the censors as American television was, or it was in a different way. And so if you'd watch a program from a British program, it could be a little bit more risque than, I mean, for crying out loud, we, at the time Benny Hill was out, we couldn't have done that and think
I'm
Benny
not.
Hill.
Certainly not claiming that we've ever been able to compete with you lot in terms of conservatism.
It's like, you're trying nowadays, but you're not getting
yes,
there.
Yes, but you set the bar high.
I tell you. Or low, depends on what you like. But it does seem like Anne was on board with the idea, and then suddenly she's not. And I kind of get in the episode, the first time when she was not, she was kind of mad at Tom for not heeding her advice or whatever it was at the time. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When he kissed her, she doesn't know he was seeing Julia's face.
No.
Her reaction was, I don't know. Well, that was odd. She didn't hit him. She didn't say, we need to talk about this, Tom. She just...
Thank God.
Yeah, don't bother. don't bother watching the train. I'll get on the thing. I didn't get that. And then, you know, then a guy chats her up and right into his cabin. I don't know. In this one, why did she go over there and put her head on his shoulder instead of kicking him out? It's like, yeah, why don't you go find some, Tom? Here's the door.
Because, as I say, I think she's not unattracted to him. Doesn't mean she's going to leap into bed straight away, but maybe rest her head on his shoulder, yeah.
Maybe that's sympathy still. Well, he's probably still mourning his wife. And in fact, I think that was kind of in the context of his problem sleeping, wasn't it? Hasn't that been sort of a running theme that really at nighttime he just doesn't... He isn't sleeping, and I kind of get the impression he's drinking a lot at bedtime. But then again, different era, a lot more alcohol.
You're going to make another crack about us Europeans, are you?
No, actually, not even Europeans there. Just that was there was a lot more of people come home and have a stiff drink in the evenings. In whether it was in television or in real life, that just seems like that was more of a thing.
Yeah. At least by then they were advising people, you know, not to get back in their car after that fifth pint.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but I do kind of get the impression, you know, when some of the scenes where he sits down and he's, you know, it's like the empty room. I'm troubled. My wife's dead. Grab a drink, put on the radio or the record player. And then, you know, kick something in disgust because I'm upset. And it just kind of feels like every night he's disturbed. And I was not expecting him to fall into the, well, actually what I need is a drink and a woman kind of attitude. That was just seemed a bit, I don't know. And again, why did Julia's face appear over Anne's face if not to make him do that? And is it because he wanted to do it and he projected Julia's face? Or is Julia's spirit wanted him to do that? Or is it somebody...
Well, I think that is a good question. And that certainly is the one piece of evidence that I would say does support your theory, even if I'm not fully subscribed to it. If that doesn't explain it, we need something else to explain it.
Maybe the Omega people want him to breed. I don't know. It's just, I hope it's not nothing. It has to be something. There has to be something going on there.
I don't know. I'm just not, I'm never going to be fully subscribed to this idea that you need to in some way be under some kind of influence to be attracted to Anne.
Okay, I'm not saying that. I am not saying that. I just feel like, I still feel like that there is some, not just societal expectation that you would not start trying to hop in bed with someone else after your spouse was killed horribly in a car accident of your own fault, but that there is also an emotional one that Tom doesn't seem to have. He doesn't seem broken up enough about his wife's death.
No, I think that's true. Although, again, there are a couple of reasons that might be that aren't entirely within the story. And what one would be, it could kind of drag the whole thing down a bit if every episode involved a lot of agonizing and, you know, self-pity. And also the kind of very, I can't remember what word I've used before, but the very sudden editing, shall we say.
Yeah,
that could well be hiding. The great thing about the sudden editing is it jumps you forward to you know the bits that move the story forward. You know, it does that 10, 15 years before Law and Order came and really shifted it for everyone else.
Do you think they just didn't have a fader?
I've definitely come round to the idea that it's a deliberate thing because we've gone through several different directors and it still feels to me like you hit the end of hit the end of a scene, but it's actually hit the end of a dialogue exchange because as soon as they stop talking, it's boom, you're into the next thing. And so there's all sorts. Well, I mean, what that does is, I mean, you can have really quite quite short scenes, but also that the kind of implications of what they've just discussed. Well, then you can assume that they've gone away and done something, and then the next scene can be about discussing the aftermath of that. So you don't have to witness every aspect of every, you know, waking moment of the story. And therefore, if Tom's feeling down, if he's crying into a pint in a bar somewhere or whatever, we don't have to see that, because actually we're just following the bits of this that move the story along.
Which would imply that some of the scenes, like with him and Anne, are supposed to be moving the story along.
Yeah. And they are, because they're the characters that we're interested in. I just mean, it leaves me with a sense that when I'm watching that scene thinking, you know, where was Tom last night? It doesn't seem impossible to me that he might have been getting maudlin over his memories of Julia. I don't know. That may be overstretching the point, but I think there is definitely a way in which the editing in this does let you kind of jump over certain things that can get assumed. I think the writing is clever enough to avoid unhelpful ambiguity about what's going on. I mean, there are some obviously very deliberate ambiguities in here, but just because something isn't shown on screen, you're not left with any sense that it may or may not have happened.
Okay, so in 1970s Scotland, how long between the time someone is spontaneously combusted and they get buried?
Good point. Good example, because it's got to be a week or two, right?
I'm genuinely not sure, but I would assume that it's at least several days. I would guess there's probably a post-mortem when a guy spontaneously catches fire in a hospital. Uh-huh. So, you know, let's say at least 1 or 2 days, and then you have to arrange it, and seems like it should take a while. That is cut out completely.
Yeah, which is exactly the kind of thing I mean.
But furthermore, during that whole time, Jenny is experiencing the flashbacks to Effie, because she says so after the funeral. She says, you've got to do it again because you never told me to forget. And so that's been the whole time she must have been going through this. So that's been quite a while.
Yeah.
That she's been living with that. And I guess it's not really important, but it does feel like it's the next day because of the way
it feels like she's had more than a day of that. She's quite upset by it, and it feels like she might have had a week of. Yeah, no, I agree. The editing, if this were the first episode you watched, the editing would say that's the next day. You have to listen to the dialogue, and you have to, you know, things like the assumption you just made about how long it would take to arrange the funeral or whatever. You have to figure those things out. It doesn't matter that you don't know exactly whether it's 5 days or 10 days, but it's certainly not tomorrow.
Do you think that was stock footage of people getting into the cars and driving out? Because there was that line where they said, you should be with the family. First, they were the only ones at the graveside. Then when they leave, they go, you should be with the family. And they look across and there's like people coming out and getting into the cars. It looks like a big deal funeral, and they drive off. And I thought, that is kind of an odd scene. Why did they pay for the extras? Oh, I get it. They didn't. That's from some other show that they just borrowed a funeral scene from, so the guy wouldn't look like a lonely sad sack who only had 3 friends and a nice burial and a fairly expensive seeming kind of plot. But
I don't agree. I think it's an important shot because it illustrates the fact that Jenny feels responsible for Ian's death, which at the point where she made that comment, I was wondering about, you know, to what extent does she realize the connection between what happened to her and what happened to him?
Okay, two other things. One, I'm just going to throw something back that occurred to me after we had talked a little bit about the science-y aspect of the show. I know that the show was shot in Scotland because Scotland was, you know, as they were trying to sort of...
Scotland's lovely, that's why.
It is, and I'm not even... making, that's not what I'm getting at, but it's not London, and it's not uncommon for, again, from an outsider's view, you're watching English television or movies, the occult stuff never occurs in London. It always occurs further north in smaller towns and villages, because you get the Wicker Man and you've got all that. And I'm picking it, but you know, that's probably the most common example of it. But there's lots of examples of it.
Well, that's the Hebrides or something.
Yeah. This is, well, that's further north, as if I'm not
well,
mistaken.
Yeah.
It's like Edinburgh is.
But it's probably
Edinburgh
it's probably,
is a pretty darn big city.
I'm now starting to wonder whether actually London is probably closer to Edinburgh than the Hebrides.
I wouldn't surprise
my geography's not up to saying for certain, but
it wouldn't surprise me. But I guess what I'm getting at is it germane to this story that they are in a place where it is more plausible that, like, for example, when Tom went to see the woman with the second sight, that there's a population of more country folk. She seemed more country folk than city folk. That's what I'm getting at, is that,
yeah,
that the occult is more of an old times thing, and Edinburgh allows us to have a modern city where you can have a research facility and still be populated by a lot of local country characters that believe in the old ways and the occult and etc. And I'm wondering
I can't imagine this being anywhere other than Edinburgh, because it just, you know, they use it so much and it feels so much, you know, five episodes in, halfway through, it feels so much part of the tapestry of the show. But I'm not sure that it is that integral to the plot. Where do you think Unit HQ is in early 70s Doctor Who?
I have always felt that Unit HQ was probably more west of London.
Do you think it might have been in Slough? Not
well. I couldn't get the
not the city centre.
My geography is pretty bad as well. I can kind of tell you where, you know. Sussex,
yeah. Well, I'm picking somewhere.
It does seem to be more out into the country than being in central London.
Then there's no reason why Department 7 couldn't. If UNIT can base their headquarters outside of the city, then why couldn't Department 7? But if you take a more unambiguous example, in the Avengers, where very, very clearly they live in central London, it doesn't stop any number of episodes being set in the kind of home counties Avengers land, where you have an ample supply of bumpkins suitable for.
But they do
plots
have to go there.
Yes, they do.
They
but
do have to
they
go
just
there.
Have in to this, hop in a car and a jump cut later, they've arrived.
In this, it feels like they live amongst them.
Well, I don't know about that.
I feel that, except in the first episode, they have gone a long way towards making it not feel like they're in central Edinburgh.
Oh, I think they are.
Their choice of locations are always tend to be, I wouldn't say rustic, but obviously, and there are a lot of cool old buildings in Edinburgh, right in the center, for that matter. But I don't know. I get that feeling that it adds to the atmosphere, in not just coincidentally we're shooting in Edinburgh, but that we needed to not be in London. I think, anyway, my observation. But I feel like you could find a woman down the street who had the second sight that could tell you all about the old ways, where they are, and I don't think they could have done that in Tom's apartment. So, you know, you have to meet a guy in a John Pertwee outfit at a pub to get him to talk a little bit about it. And even there's sort of a flair that doesn't come off as you know, a true believer, but as a modern interpreter of it. So, anyway. Okay, so
Gaiman's Neverwhere, for example, creates an entire alternative London. So it could be set there, but it would be a different show, I think. You know, Edinburgh is part of what the Omega Factor is.
Okay, so last thing. The college theatre play we see at the end in the black room and the dark suits and just the head showing and...
it wasn't quite as bad as the Doctor versus Omega in The Three Doctors, but getting that way.
It was okay. It was effective. I don't want to. I poo-poo it only because it was so obviously a theater technique.
But it's also. That seemed to me an example of something where, with modern budgets and what you could do with the money, it would have been an opportunity to actually take quite a lot of the episode and translate the characters into a period setting and have a bit of fun with that, because as they kind of regressed to the land of Effie, they would have been able to take Effie and Tom back there and do something. But clearly their budget didn't extend beyond taking them into an empty studio and lighting them individually,
putting them in little black outfits. So
yeah.
So what did you? I mean, my interpretation of that scene was that there was Jenny. Tom comes to her rescue. The demon stands behind her and uses his powers to draw her closer to him. Tom tries to pull her away. So I mean, not this is not a subtle metaphor here. And then Morag shows up behind him, and she's helping pulling him along. Does Tom even know that's Morag? He doesn't seem to look at her. It's just another grab from behind and pulling him. We see it.
I don't know.
And why did he stab her?
Well, I mean, without knowing whether he knows who it was, it's hard to say.
But didn't he feel like she was helping him? Because she clearly
That was the thing I was wondering about, because I don't think that's clear. It seems like she's pulling Tom away from Mr. Satan, but in doing so, she's also pulling him away from rescuing Effie. So she's, in the sense,
trying to prevent him from saving her.
Yeah, she's helping Satan by preventing Tom from interfering with what he's doing. So she could be helping him, or she could be protecting Tom, and that's really not clear. I assumed she was protecting Tom up to the point where he stabbed her, when I thought, oh, you know, maybe he thinks something different there.
Interesting. I could go back and watch it again and see if maybe there's something in the timing of when she pulls him, but I just felt, so for example, if he goes to reach Jenny and she grabs him and pulls him back, then yes, she's trying to prevent him. And if he grabs hold of Jenny and then she tries to pull him back, I would interpret that as her trying to help pull. And you make a good case that maybe she was impeding
him. He doesn't acquiesce. She may be trying to protect him. You may be right, but he doesn't allow it. He doesn't allow himself to be protected and pulled away, because he's actually putting the rescuing of Jenny above his own safety in that regard. So either way, he doesn't want her to do what she's doing, whatever her intentions are.
Okay. All right. So we don't know. And then we don't know if Morag is actually dead, because what was it that he stabbed?
I'm going to say not. I'm going to say not.
Okay.
For a number of reasons, not least of which I think we need the Morag mystery resolved. But I mean, what we clearly have now established is that Morag can have an independent post-Drexel existence, because our theory... Assuming Drexel's really dead, which seems fairly unambiguous in terms of what we were shown. And we had supposed or posited as a possible explanation for what Morag was that he was somehow projecting her. Clearly, she's still around. The fact that he stabbed her, well, he stabbed a kind of... she's obviously not there in the church, so he hasn't stabbed a physical, corporeal version of her. He's stabbed some kind of mind manifestation of her.
And if
Mr. Satan, if he is Martindale or whatever, he gets knocked down, but Martindale has no ill effects from that. So
fair enough.
If Morag is not purely spectral, and there is a she has a physical body somewhere else, it's possible that then whatever being stabbed in the dream world has no effect on her physical body.
But we do have, for this time, let's look back at Morag's appearances. She was in the bookstore while Drexler was there. Drexel. So that she seemed, I think she even may have opened or closed the door. So she did seem to have a physical manifestation. At the end of the episode.
Or she was capable of moving physical objects.
Right. Well, that's a sort of physical manifestation. She appeared at the funeral.
I'm inclined to think she does have a physical
body. So at the hospital in this episode, was that a physical manifestation? Because only 2 out of 3 people saw her, and then she was gone.
Yes, so but that wasn't her physical body. Yes, we know she does that because we've seen that before, haven't we? I mean, for example, when he's driving and she's in this, before Julia gets killed.
Assuming she wasn't actually just standing there.
Yeah, okay, I'm making an assumption, fair point.
It does seem weird that she's always in that same sort of spectral robe that she wears, but yeah.
Well, you don't know that. She may have an entire wardrobe
she full might.
Of identical spectral robes. Till you go around her house and check, you can't be certain.
That's true. Steve Jobs had an entire wardrobe halfway of the demon's outfit in this episode.
She is Steve Jobs, yeah.
So now, all right, I think the answer is just going to be conceit on the part of the filmmaker, but Tom manages to pull her out of her own head, and so there is no Tom or Jenny to see the demon turn into Martindale.
Yes.
Well, what could that be other than just meant to be something to tease the audience? Because there's
could
no...
Be that Tom, you know, it could be that Tom, that's what Tom sees, you know.
A tree falls in the woods, does it make a sound? Well, if a demon turns into Martindale when there's nobody there, like what was it for?
But you don't think Tom saw that?
I don't think Tom saw that. No, I don't. I think he was gone.
Well, I don't know what it means in that case.
I find it hard to believe that he would not have a reaction, considering the state he was in when Martindale...
Except that he's completely spaced out when he comes around.
Well, if the last thing I saw before going out was Martindale as a demon, I might have a strange reaction to him when he...
Or he might not remember it.
Yeah. Well, if a tree falls in the forest and someone can't remember hearing it, did it really happen? So.
Don't know. You'd have to go back and check on the tree.
I suppose you could do that, but... Anyway, all right. Well, I don't have anything else. I thought it was a effectively creepy episode. I wouldn't exactly say it frightened me, but I mean, I'm sitting there at night watching it, and it's like, yeah, you know, it seems colder in this room than it should. I thought it did a pretty good job of conveying the sort of spookiness that we have not had in the last couple of episodes.
Either that, or Morag was sitting next to you.
It could be that. It could be that. That was the ghosty thing. Anyway, unless you have anything else?
No.
All right. Well, then, Simon, thank you for joining me.
It's a pleasure, as always.
And listeners, I do hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes or stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/FusionPatrol. Our Twitter username is @FusionPatrol, or you can just send us a comment at feedback@FusionPatrol.com. Come check out our new YouTube channel at youtube.com/FusionPatrol. Please, come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.